You're listening to the Hayek Program Podcast. This podcast includes audio from lectures, interviews, and discussions from scholars and visitors of the F.A. Hayek Program for Advanced Study in Philosophy, Politics, and Economics at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. To learn more about the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. To learn about graduate student fellowship opportunities with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org.
My name is Chris Coyne, and I am the Associate Director of the F.A. Hayek Program for Advanced Study in Philosophy, Politics, and Economics. And today, I am joined by Brigetta Jones. Brigetta is a PhD student here in the Department of Economics at George Mason University and a graduate fellow with the F.A. Hayek Program. Brigetta, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
I am excited because we are continuing with this series of recordings discussing the work of Kenneth Boulding. And what we're talking about today is a paper that you and I worked on jointly as part of the special issue of the Review of Austrian Economics that we're putting together on Kenneth Boulding's thought and its relevance for today. And the title of the paper we are going to be discussing is The Political Economy of Millwork. And so let's start with this odd word, millwork. Boulding used that word, and we take it as an entry point to have a discussion from an economic standpoint of what that organization's activities entail and how to think about it. So can you begin by talking a little bit about what Boulding's concept of millwork is and what he meant by introducing that term?
Yeah. So the concept of millwork, the kind of technical definition we give in the paper, is the entire network of public and private organizations that are involved in the war industry. So I really like this term millwork because it goes beyond just merely what we think of the military as far as just the Department of Defense, but it also includes every private organization that's also wrapped up in producing goods and services for the military. So places like Lockheed Martin, Boeing, Northrop Grumman, anyone who's producing anything that ultimately is used by the military. And so it's this nice broader term that Boulding has that I think helps us to just see the larger scope of the military sector in our lives.
Yeah. And so there's a parallel here, perhaps, between what Boulding calls the millwork, what others might call the military-industrial complex, harkening back, of course, to President Eisenhower's farewell address in the early 60s. And as you mentioned, the nice component, if you will, of the concept is that it captures the breadth of the military sector. But also, I think the other thing that's unique about it, which then transitions into the next thing I want to discuss with you, is that analytically, so from the perspective of economic analysis, the millwork deserves a special kind of analysis unto itself because it is not purely public. It is not purely private. It is an entanglement between public agencies and organizations, between private firms. But the other thing I should mention is that it also has kind of secondary and tertiary effects. So, for instance, when you have a public, the Department of War, let's say, it also requires office supplies and accountants and paper shredding and all this other kind of mundane stuff. But then the reach of that organization is going to touch upon many different aspects of the economy. So that then leads to the next question, which is really at the heart of the paper. Because after defining the concept of millwork, what we do is we say, okay, let's put our economics eyeglasses on and think through fundamental economic questions. And we identify four of them in our analysis. And so can you spend a little bit of time walking us through each of those questions, why they're important, how we think about them from both a epistemic and knowledge and an incentive component? And if you are able to do that, I think it will give the listeners a good sense of kind of the core arguments of the paper and why it matters.
Yeah, I love that. For the mill org, it's unique because the way it makes economic decisions as far as like what goods are going to be produced and how they're going to be priced and all those questions is answered in a different way than like a purely private firm or purely the government. So the first question we ask in the paper is what is to be produced? So how do the people in the mill org even decide what goods and services should be produced? The final end of the mill org, the kind of goal they have is to produce national security. And then there's kind of a lot of different goods and services that go towards that end. And ultimately, we can think of the beneficiaries of national security as the citizens. So they're kind of like the final consumers of this national security. But the role they play in determining how that's produced is much different than if they were to buy something on the market, like buying clothing. Buying national security is very different. So when we talk about what is to be produced, there's kind of two key things about the mill org, and that's the epistemic issues. So the knowledge that the people in the organization have access to decide not just what is to be produced, but all of the questions we ask in the paper. And then also their incentives. So how they're incentivized to produce different things and how they make these decisions based on the incentives that they face, which is a little different than in the private context. So for what is to be produced, typically in the private market, producers know what they should produce based on market signals. So consumers are buying certain goods, they're not buying other goods, and that's what tells producers what is of value to produce and how they're going to make final profits, which is what they're incentivized by. A producer in the market context that's making lattes realizes which ones consumers are buying, which ones consumers aren't buying. So they have knowledge about what consumers value. That informs them. That's this epistemic point. And then they're also incentivized to produce what consumers value, because at the end of the day, they get to keep the profits of however many lattes they sell and how much extra money they made. And both of those are different in the context of the mill org. So because consumers aren't directly buying fighter jets and military personnel, the government officials are the ones who make the decisions about what types of goods and services need to be produced. And they don't have any of these consumer valuations, so they lack that epistemic point. And then there are also the incentives these government officials face is a bit different. So since the government is a nonprofit organization, they don't gain profits from producing the type of national security that the final consumers, the citizens, value. Rather, they get other benefits from their decision-making around this point. But it comes in the form of votes for politicians or in the form of job security or higher salaries for the bureaucrats. And so they're going to be incentivized to choose what to produce based on those things. Usually this translates to, for bureaucrats, they might want to produce more goods and services for the military just to have a larger bureau at the end of the day, because this will give them more job security and higher salaries down the line, as long as they continue producing things that may prove that they're necessary and funds can go their way. So that's the first part about what is to be produced, the kind of two key differences. And then in the paper, the next question we ask is what price and quantity they're going to produce these goods at. So how they determine the price of a fighter jet or how many that they need. And this is also pretty unique for the way that the mill org operates, again, on this epistemics point and this incentives point. So because the mill org is not a for-profit industry, they don't have access to competitive prices, which normally tell private market entrepreneurs what to produce. So normally, because of the rivalry over scarce resources, producers find out which resources consumers value, how much they value these things, and consumers kind of help determine what a good market price is. That creates value, which ultimately translates into profits for these producers. And that's the same thing on the incentives point. Normal entrepreneurs in the private market context want to price goods accordingly to maximize their profits, create value for consumers, and so they can take these profits home at the end of the day. And this is, again, different in the context of the mill org, because the government officials don't have access to these profits, and so they're less incentivized to maybe efficiently price the goods so that they get those take-home profits. And also they lack the knowledge of knowing exactly how much consumers value a fighter jet and how that translates into a price. And so this is very difficult. In reality, usually they'll use historical pricing, like what did fighter jets cost in the past, or they'll do a little bit of competitive bidding between different firms that are producing these goods and services for the military. But again, it looks a little different because they lack this knowledge of these valuations because of the lack of the market process. Okay, so the third question we ask in the paper is, how is it to be produced? So this is determined not only by the government officials, but also by these private firms. There's kind of an entanglement there, and they both work together to ultimately determine how it is to be produced. So the government officials have a large say, first off, in which firms can produce these different goods and services. Again, on the epistemics point, they lack the knowledge to be able to tell maybe like which firms are the most efficient at producing different goods and services for the military. And so they have to rely on other methods. And often this translates into working with the same firms that you've worked with before. And so they have an approved contractors list of who can produce goods for the military sector. And then they'll continue to work with those same producers. And then there's also an incentive point in that because the government officials don't take home these profits at the end of the day, they're a little less incentivized maybe also to find out which firms are the most efficient. And so how these firms are determined is more through the political process and like who has these political relationships rather than based on the market context. So once it's determined which firms are going to produce goods and services for the military sector, there's also unique differences within the firms about how they produce these goods and services. So again, without the market prices that tell producers what consumers value and what would be like the best use of their resources, the firms will have different kind of go-arounds. So they often use cost-plus contracts where they determine, based on the input resources they're using for a certain product, how much those cost, and then there'll be a certain profit margin above that. And that is their take-home profits. But it's a little more structured. So if you're a normal producer on the private market and you want to maximize your profits, create consumer value, you might find lower cost methods and that drives down your cost and it'll drive up your profits. But with cost plus contracts, for example, if you lower your costs, you just lower your cost plus contract. And so your profits aren't actually increasing. And so we might see not necessarily the lowest cost methods being used to produce goods and services for the military. So they might have like extra people who are hired on hand, whether they're necessary or not, just because they're not going to capture the profits from lowering those costs. And the last question we ask in the paper is kind of with whose resources. So that's the final difference, is how the mil-org gets the resources or the capital to produce all of these things is different than a firm on the private market producing things. So instead of having to like raise capital through investment, the mil-org can use other methods that the government uses, like taxation, so they can directly tax whenever they need more resources to produce the good of national security. It's much easier for them, the mil-org, to raise funds than a private business. They can also get more resources in labor through like conscription, which is maybe less popular today than it used to be, but that's another lever they have. Or they can even directly ration. So this is maybe something we haven't seen in a while, but the mil-org has utilized in the past as a way to get resources to their final end. And whether it's directly rationing, which changes the prices of many goods and services in the market, even consumer goods, or whether it's just taxation or printing money, any way that they raise funds, all of this is going to affect the broader capital structure of the market. And so our two points here is on the epistemics point. Once this capital has gone to the military sector, to the mil-org, there's no way to know what would be like the highest value of this capital in a different context. There's kind of what we have used the term, this stifled discovery process, where if that capital didn't go to the military, what would it have been used for on the consumer market? How would they have valued that money to produce things that people desire is something we'll kind of never know. And because of the process, we can't say that it's being used for the mil-org because that's what consumers value the most. It's just government officials have dictated that that's where the funds are going. And then the incentives point also affects the broader capital market in that government officials can just take this money and use it towards the mill org. And it doesn't necessarily have to be the highest valued use because they're not capturing these profits. Whereas like a producer on the private market would normally be incentivized to move resources, move capital to their highest valued uses because they get to take home those profits at the end of the day. And because the government officials lack those incentives, then they are less incentivized, yeah, to move capital to its highest valued use. So those are kind of the four cap questions that we ask and kind of breaking it down, just looking at how the institutional structure of the mill org affects how these decisions are made. Kind of same people in different contexts that now have a different access to knowledge about valuations and also now are faced with different incentives. And so that's going to affect their decision making in this unique context compared to a normal private market firm on the competitive market process.
Yeah, well, thank you for that breakdown. That's extremely useful, both for clarifying the central arguments of the paper, but I think it really honing in on the core fact that you never escape the core economic problem, which on the one hand is common sense. You face scarcity, and so you got to figure out how to allocate scarce resources. But when it comes to matters of whether you want to call it defense or security or what have you, it's oftentimes forgotten. Of course, state provision of defense is grounded in economic logic, the kind of traditional logic of Samuelsonian public goods. And one of the things that Balding's discussion of mill org invites us to do, although he never does it, which is the gap you and I are trying to fill, is to say, look, if you're going to justify state provision on economic grounds, all fine and good, perhaps, let's take that as given, but then you also have to subject the decision-making of how stuff is produced, what is produced, and so on, the questions you laid out for us, you also have to subject those to economic analysis as well. That is, you can't simply assert that the state is going to do what you want it to do when you just say, provide defense. And then the issue becomes, of course, as your very concise and nuanced summary got us to think about, the market process becomes replaced by the political process. But in this case, you actually get like the political process dominates, but it entangles with the market process. And so you get these fascinating decision-making processes, but also distortions perhaps as well. And that point about distortions leads me to the final question I want to ask you, which is in 1969, Balding was invited to testify in front of Congress on the military budget and military spending. And you and I draw upon this quotation from his testimony in the conclusion. And I want to read it so the listeners can know what we're talking about, and then I'd like to hear any reactions you have to it. So this is Kenneth Balding in 1969 testifying before Congress. The war industry is a cancer within the body of American society. It has its own mode of growth. It represents a system which is virtually independent and indeed objectively inimical to the welfare of the American people, in spite of the fact that it still visualizes itself as their protector. Balding's not holding back there. He has some strong language referring it to the war industry as a cancer. And given that, and given our analysis in the paper, if you had to kind of highlight what you think the contemporary relevance is or the ongoing importance of these insights are for understanding economic activity today, what would you highlight?
Yeah, I love that quote, especially the end of it, speaking to how we still visualize it as our protector, even though he's saying it's this cancer upon us. And I think the important thing about this paper and this discussion is that often we see like there's a public goods problem, like provide national defense, the government steps in and they do that. And maybe we kind of stop thinking about it. They're providing defense. They're figuring out what the appropriate amount of national security looks like. But our paper kind of digs into what does that process actually look like? How are they actually making those decisions? Is it actually in a way that we value, or is it something that we should be concerned about? The military in the U.S. like is a large component of our economy. And so just turning a blind eye to the inner workings of what it's doing and how it's affecting the broader process, you know, it's pulling all these resources and these capital away from what else they could have been used for, and it's going towards the military. And so to investigate that, I think, is extremely important. The MIL-ORG is definitely something we'll have with us for a long time, and we won't be able to escape these problems of incentives and epistemics just based on the institutional structure of the way that it operates. And so I think the takeaway from the paper is just to discuss that there's real economic costs from the operation of the MIL-ORG, and it's not necessarily just the government is providing this good of national security and one and done, but something we should turn a closer eye to. Yeah.
Yeah. I that's all, I think, excellent. And then the other kind of key aspect is that the effects are also wide ranging, right? It's there's all the it's just the classic kind of seen and unseen. So there's stuff we see. We see the movement of resources from here to there. As you mentioned it, though, there's the unseen. In your earlier response, I think, to the last question, you highlighted the point about that there's a discovery process we don't see because of the redirection of resources. That can be physical resources that would have been used elsewhere. That can be entrepreneurial alertness. And I think why Boulding invokes that language of a cancer, which is quite strong and obviously has a negative connotation, is because he realized that military production, very much in line with recent thinkers like, for instance, the economic historian Robert Higgs on wartime spending during the World Wars, he realized that military spending in the raw doesn't generate economic prosperity because you are necessarily taking goods and services and entrepreneurial alertness that could be used to produce genuine wealth and using it to fulfill government plans about war-making stuff. Now, of course, war-making, whether that's good or bad, is neither here nor there for this part of our conversation. I talk about that in some of the other podcast episodes with other guests. But I think that's a really important aspect, the parasitic nature of the enterprise and the fact that it has real effects which work at odds with the well-being of citizens. And so at a minimum, whether people agree or disagree with that statement, Boulding pushes us to think about it and reflect upon it and to take on the challenge of analyzing it. Brigetta, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today about our paper. Again, the title of the paper is The Political Economy of MIL-ORG. It will be forthcoming in a special issue of the Review of Austrian Economics that explores the economic, social, and political thought of Kenneth Boulding and its relevance today. Brigetta, thank you so much.
Thank you. This is a pleasure.
Today, I am excited to be joined by two of my colleagues, Dr. Nathan Goodman, who's a senior fellow with the F.A. Hayek program, and Dr. Carla Segovia, who is a research fellow with the F.A. Hayek program. Nathan and Carla, thank you so much for being here. We are discussing today your paper, which is co-authored, I should mention, with Abby Hall. Abby, I interviewed for part of this podcast series on Kenneth Boulding on the Book Stable piece, which fits with your paper. So I urge listeners to listen to that interview and discussion separately if you haven't already. But your paper titled Unstable Peace in El Salvador draws directly upon these concepts in Boulding's Stable Peace. And so, Nathan, let me start with you. Your paper leverages Stable Peace by Kenneth Boulding to analyze the Salvadorian Civil War. And so I want to ask you to begin by telling us about Boulding's concept of Stable Peace and how thinking about conflict through this lens, rather than a simple dichotomy of peace and war, changes how we think about these issues.
Thanks so much, Chris. So yeah, in his book, Stable Peace, Kenneth Boulding introduces a concept of stable peace, which he then contrasts with other states of conflictual relations, such as stable war or unstable peace and unstable war. And so I want to go into what all of those are, but first I want to talk about the distinction between conflict and non-conflict. So all these taxonomies are useful because when we can classify aspects of how our social world works, we can then use those classifications for analytical purposes. And so to think about war and peace, it's helpful to first think about conflict and non-conflict. So if you and I have interests that are aligned or that are complementary, then we will be in a state of non-conflict, right? Suppose that we want to co-author a paper, we have similar ends in wanting to co-author a paper, we both want to publish in a good journal, we both want to advance understanding of issues related to war and peace. We're in a situation of non-conflict at that point in time. But suppose that we then find ourselves in a situation of zero-sum conflict, right? So maybe I want the paper to reach one conclusion, you want the paper to reach another conclusion, right? At that point, we can't both achieve our ends if those conclusions are contradictory to each other, right? So we are in a situation of conflict. But notice that being in a situation of conflict does not necessarily mean being in a state of war. In fact, it would be quite unusual if a group of co-authors decided that as a result of disagreeing on what a paper should conclude, they should bomb each other's homes or shoot each other, right? That would be really unusual, and it would cross what Boulding calls the taboo line, right? So the taboo line refers to a set of social norms that set some modes of human behavior outside the feasible set, outside the set of things that we'll even consider. And so that means we'll consider question, what means are we willing to consider to achieve our ends when we are in conflict with one another? That really gets at being a crucial part of the concept of stable peace. That is to say, stable peace occurs when two countries or two groups or two individuals are in a situation where the possibility of war doesn't even enter their calculations. So looking at this at an interpersonal level, you and I are in a position of stable peace. It never crosses my mind that Chris Coyne is going to declare war against me. It never crosses my mind that I should declare war against you. And I hope it never crosses your mind that you should declare war on me, right? And Boulding largely applies this to the level of countries, right? So these days, the leaders of Britain and France don't seriously consider going to war with one another. But note that it wasn't always that way. Britain and France have actually been at war many times in human history. And when that was a more common occurrence, you could say that situations when they were at peace were situations of unstable peace. That is, the leaders of Britain had to consider, well, how do we raise up an army if France goes to war with us? The leaders of France had to consider, how will we raise up an army if Britain goes to war with us? So that's a situation of unstable peace, a situation where for individuals in those two countries, the possibility of war factors seriously into their calculations, right? Likewise, a war can be stable or unstable. A war that is ongoing and with no end in sight, a war where people think we are going to be at war and I don't see a way out of it, that's stable war. By contrast, if people perceive that the path towards peace exists, that they could transition from war to peace, then they are in a situation of unstable war. And so you'll notice that right here, one way in which Boulding's approach is distinctive is an emphasis on the subjective dimension, right? An emphasis on the expectations and beliefs of people, of ordinary human beings, whether they're leaders or whether they're regular citizens or soldiers or anything else, their perception of whether peace is possible, of whether war is likely and worth taking into account in their calculations, all of that matters a great deal. Because if you anticipate that war is likely, you're going to be preparing for war, and your preparations for war might help the other party see, oh, war against that person is likely, and they'll prepare for war, and vice versa. It creates a vicious cycle. Likewise, if you anticipate peace with one another, you may be continuously seeking both peaceful ways of resolving your conflicts and mutually beneficial ways of engaging in cooperation, something that you will be less likely to do if you anticipate violent conflict with the other person. And so this subjectivist dimension allows us to understand the meanings that people attach to things. And that's very different than some more potentially empirically tractable approaches to studying war and conflict, right? You can measure how much trade is happening between two countries. You can measure rainfall shocks and see, oh, did the decline in rainfall lead to people being poorer and therefore more desperate and therefore more likely to use violence and engage in civil war. There's a whole literature of studies that do this, right? So that's looking at the observable elements of things and seeing how those affect war, peace, and conflict. But what Boulding offers us is a way to consider the role that people's perceptions play and how that allows us to understand the dynamic process of change from peace to war and vice versa. And that focus on dynamic change and on the human mind enables us to understand some things that purely looking at what's empirically tractable, we might miss.
Thanks, Nathan. That was wonderful. So if I had to summarize, and I want to do my best to summarize some of the key points you raised and asked you if you have anything I missed. The framing that Boulding offers us is, number one, a phase taxonomy. So there's different phases. This was your point about stable peace, unstable peace, stable violence, unstable violence, which means there's the possibility of movement between phases, which introduces some conception of time. Through time, we can potentially move for better or for worse between those phases. There's a component of agency in Boulding. So there are structural factors within which people are embedded, but people all also have choices to varying degrees, of course, depending on the constraints they face. But they have the ability to shape the world within which they live, for better or for worse. And then there's this really important aspect of subjectivism that you emphasize towards the end of your comments. And here we see a connection between Boulding's other book, The Image, but also F.A. Hayek's work on the facts of the social sciences. Do you think that's an accurate summary and connection there with the Austrians and Hayek in terms of subjective views of the world?
Yes, absolutely. I think that Kenneth Boulding was a thoroughly subjectivist economist. And in that sense, he has a lot of commonality with scholars in the Austrian tradition. You mentioned Hayek and his The Facts of the Social Sciences, which really emphasizes that the facts of the social sciences are what people believe and think, and that objects in the social sciences aren't understood in terms of their physical properties, but in terms of people's beliefs, purposes, and plans with regards to them, right? A tool isn't a tool because it has some set of physical, chemical, or optical properties. It's a tool because it's something that someone wants to make use of. A clock isn't a clock because it has a pendulum in it. It's a clock because it's something that people use to discern what the time is within a particular time zone so that they can coordinate their plans with other people who are using a similar conception of time. Likewise, war is not simply about bullets or machete blades cutting human flesh or piercing human flesh or what have you, right? Though that particular physical reality of violence is an important part of war. Just as important for war is people's ongoing beliefs about their ability to engage in violent efforts to achieve their ends versus their ability to engage in nonviolent efforts to achieve their ends, and their ongoing plans to continue preparing for and engaging in violence against other people. And so the facts of the social sciences are directly relevant to this and directly dovetail with Boulding's conception of it. So Hayek and Boulding are really on the same page here. And I would also add that other Austrians who really emphasize this subjectivist perspective, like Ludwig Lachmann, for instance, really have a lot of complementary insights here as well.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Thank you for bringing Lachmann and others as well to make that connection. And as you mentioned, this is quite powerful because it moves us beyond, or perhaps complements and moves us beyond, more traditional quantitative approaches to conflict, which might reveal certain important aspects of the world, of course, but may also in the process neglect these subjectivist components that you and your co-authors are emphasizing. Let's turn to the situation in El Salvador, because one of the things I really appreciated about your paper was the connection between kind of that conceptual framing that you just so nicely summarized for us, Nathan, and this application to El Salvador. And so, Carla, let me turn to you and ask you to discuss this. After going through and talking about the components that Nathan went through, you pull in a few other concepts from Boulding as well, specifically his idea of strain, which is those things that are either conducive or not to phase changes, and strength, which is the system's ability to withstand strain. And I was hoping that you could tell our listeners a little bit about those categories and how they fit in with the concrete case of the Salvadorian civil war. And perhaps you can highlight some of what you and your co-authors identify as the significant strain and strength variables.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think what's really important is to think of El Salvador, you know, in the early 1800s, a set of government policies wanted to really push for coffee production. And this ended up causing a lot of the land to be held in very few hands. And so these hands became what we call like the coffee oligarchy, which is very commonly all Salvadorians know about this group of people that own most of the land from the, you know, early 1800s. Additionally, they have this alliance with the military. So we have a lot of power concentrated in a very small group of people. I say that because one of the biggest strain variables in El Salvador and has been historically is overwhelming poverty. And the fact that people living in rural areas were unable to own land to cultivate even subsistence crops made it very hard for people to have regular lives. So we have a lot of tension between what we could call like three groups of people, the oligarchy, the military, and also campesinos or people living in the rural areas of the country. And one of the examples of this tension rising up way before the war is in 1932, we have La Matanza, which is when the Salvadorian government responded to an uprising by murdering 30,000 Salvadorian peasants. And, you know, this is like 70 years before the war officially started. We were already in a situation where any push towards a change was always met with violence. And this was, of course, 70 years before, but especially in the early 1980s, you see a lot of things shifting quickly. Now, closer to the war, we have land reforms being enacted by the government, you know, because of this rising tension. In one side, these land reforms seem to be a way to appease peasants. But on the other side, it was making oligarchs uneasy. It was, you know, removing their property. These land reforms were enacted in such a poor way that a lot of peasants, because how they were laid out is like, if you were farming a piece of land, then now this section belongs to you, basically. And you just have to go to the, you know, to the government and say, I've been, you know, working this land and now it's mine. Because this was announced and abruptly just like allowed people to do this, then a lot of landowners started evicting people out of their, you know, pieces of land. And they also have, you know, private security and in some cases use violence in order to evict people. So there was also communal land, but none of this was it was not productive. People were unable to secure land spaces. But at the same time, oligarchs feeling more uncomfortable with their position in the country. There were a lot of strikes in the 1970s. This led to large losses in profit. And also there were a lot of violent issues stemming from the strikes. And again, make oligarchs uneasy. They don't have, you know, people are beginning to do things. And the way they are responding is violent. Another really important point, and I think we have like a large section on the role of the Catholic Church. You know, for many years, the church was a strength variable because it was a common faith that, you know, Salvadorians are mostly Catholic, and a common faith allowed them to have something in common. However, in the coming years, in the years before the war, let me explain it with an example, because in the past, in these large haciendas or, you know, plots of land, what landowners would have is a church. And in that church, they would have a resident, you know, priest that would preach to the workers. Every weekend, they would have that time and they would meet. And in a way, this was this relationship between the church and the oligarchy. They were, you know, supporting each other. But there was a rise in the liberation theology in Latin America. Therefore, a lot of priests started changing their views on what they should have been doing. And they established these Christian-based communities, which was their own way of empowering campesinos and making them aware of the things and rights and things they can do it, to advocate for themselves in this environment. However, this was also met with violence. And even in 1977, which is, you know, a couple years before the war, priests were being massacred. They were being, you know, killed in grass fields behind their churches by Salvadorian security government. So this led to a huge reduction in strength because from one side, the campesinos were more empowered to be active politically, active, you know, in assembling their own groups. A lot of these paramilitary groups originated from Christian-based communities. And it was one of those things that were also supported by the priests who decided to participate in those things. But on the other side, the oligarchy felt like they've lost an ally. One of the big moments in Salvadorian history is when the Archbishop of San Salvador was shot, you know, after he had asked for the military to stop the repression. He was shot publicly during a homily. So this was a major point in Salvadorian history. There were many attempts at political reform. There were, you know, parties established that gathered a lot of support. And, you know, when they thought that they were going to win, everyone was, you know, I think that they stopped the counting of the votes. They stopped, you know, publishing all of the vote counting. Therefore, the military government candidate had won after. So this election in 1972 was widely known as like electoral fraud. But in addition, there were other ways that the government was censoring as well. There was a public order law that allowed the military to capture people. This was in 1977. It allowed the government to capture individuals just on the basis of suspicion of being like communist or participating in any kind of armed group. And in the background of all this, I would say the land reform was an increase in strain. The strikes increase in strain. The role reversal in the Catholic Church was a reduced in strength and an increase in strain. The failed political reform was decrease in strength and increase in strain as well. But then again, every single time there is this violent response, there is an increase in the professionalization of violence. Nathan, Abby, and me have another paper on the U.S. intervention in El Salvador and the role of all that training that they did for the Salvadorian military forces. Just a small data point is that in 30 years, the army doubled in size, the Salvadorian army doubled in size. And by 1979, the army was over 7,000 people, which feels like a small amount. But again, we are talking about a small country that had started in the 1950s with a 3,000-person army. All that violence became more and more aggressive, more and more overt, from smaller things in the background to bigger things, you know, more publicly, such as the assassination of the archbishop. So yeah, we see, like Nathan explained, it was like people were trying to do things. They were trying to enact change in their society, but all of these things were met with violence. Therefore, that's when we start seeing the little by little, the increase in the armed groups on the left, the guerrillas. And they all started as small groups, you know, that didn't really coordinate with each other. They had different goals, different things. But right before the war, they went to Cuba and kind of like signed an agreement to join, effectively making the FMLN, that one guerrilla group under one flag.
All right. Well, thank you for that. You know, it's a complex history, as your comments touched upon, and there's a lot of moving parts. So I appreciate your summary of decades of activity by numerous parties interacting with each other in these complex ways. And one of the things I really appreciate about your paper, and one of the reasons I hope listeners will read the paper in its entirety, is it really serves, I think, as a useful concrete illustration of how you can use Balding's framework that Nathan was talking about to understand a real world conflict. And as you talk about in your conclusion, it might also be quite useful then to think about that framework for understanding the eventual moves towards peace, which took place in the early 1990s, pardon me. So I want to thank you both for joining me, Nathan and Carla. Again, the title of the paper is Unstable Peace in El Salvador. It is co-authored by Nathan Carla and also Abby Hall is the third co-author. It will appear in a forthcoming issue of the Review of Austrian Economics that focuses on the thought of Kenneth Bolding and its present-day relevance. Nathan and Carla, thank you both so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much, Chris.
Thank you for listening to the Hayek Program podcast. To learn more about the research, scholars, and work of the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. For more information about graduate student fellowship opportunities for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org. We hope you recommend students to our programs or consider applying yourself.